Hey, this is Cleveland Brown, and you're listening to the About Last Night podcast. I guess your TV must be broken. Haha, just kidding. Actually, I'm not kidding. You're bored.
Hey guys, Adam Ray for the About Last Night podcast. Happy Monday. What a weekend. Holy shit. Brad and I, our first celebrity all-star game with the NBA. Holy shit. Hope we get asked back. That was a blast. Thanks for everyone who watched, tuned in, sent us messages. Appreciate the love and support. And thanks to all the ALN fans that came out to our live podcast on Saturday. That was a fucking blast. The Comedy Zone, thanks for housing us. Hope to come back and do that again. It's always great when the venue is set up perfectly for the podcast. And we had a blast with you guys. And thanks to everybody that came out to my solo show on Valentine's Day. So much love was in the air. And the crowd was hot, not just figuratively, but emotionally as well. And thanks to the NBA and Adam Silver. It was a blast. You know, what can you say? Bucket list. Dream come true. That's Make-A-Wish shit right there. Today's episode is a fantastic episode. Just myself and our guest. He's been on before, a two-time ALN guest, a fan favorite. You know him from his countless specials, selling out Madison Square Garden, his numerous movies, TV show appearances. He's one of the biggest stand-up comics in the world. I'm talking about Dane Cook, back for a new episode and a new chat. And we get into a lot of stuff on this one. And it was great. You know, Dane has been doing stand-up almost 30 years. So he's got something to say about it. You know what I'm saying? I'm 12 years in. I can't imagine another 10, let alone another 15. But Dane is still crushing. Still writing, getting up all the time. And he's about to embark on a new 45-city tour starting tomorrow in New York. So he's playing some insane venues. Go to danecook.com for all those tour dates and venue info. And go see him live, because I've been lucky enough to see the material he's working on, and it's pretty fucking great. So go see him and follow him on Twitter and Instagram at Dane Cook. Follow me at Adam Ray Comedy, at Funny Brad, at ALN Podcast, aboutlastnightpodcast.com for past, present episodes and all your ALN merch. Shopadamray.com for all my merch. Just got some beanies and pins up, so go over to shopadamray.com and get some Adam Ray beanies. They make great gifts for the family. That snow is still hitting a lot of you in the Northwest, so fucking bundle up. This weekend, I'm going to be in Denver at the Comedy Works, February 21st through the 23rd, downtown Comedy Works, Thursday through Saturday. First time headlining. I can't wait. Get your tickets at AdamRayComedy.com. Brad will be in Fairbanks, Alaska at the Blue Loon Thursday. Thursday he'll be in Anchorage, and Friday and Saturday he'll be in Fairbanks at the Blue Loon. Tickets at BradWilliamsComedy.com. Make sure you subscribe on iTunes and comment. And rate the podcast on the iTunes page. Give us a 5-star rating, comment, lets us know that we are doing the right thing, and you guys can show your support that way. And tell your friends, tell your family, tell somebody about the podcast, and help spread the word about all the free, fun entertainment we're throwing at you. So many great guests coming up. Craig Ferguson, The Chainsmokers, Brian Friedman, Adam Devine, holy shit, Ron Funches, Pete Holmes. It's going to be a good next couple months for the ALN podcast, and today is no exception. So now that we've got the tour dates, Twitter handles, and merch info out of the way, sit back, relax, and enjoy a brand new episode of the About Last Night podcast with the very funny Dane Cook.
Well, the weekend's over, so it's time to chat about it. Got a midget and a Jew, so why don't you sit down and listen to a dope podcast. Dinner or breakfast, Brad Williams and Adam Ray are here for you any time of the day. So come on and treat yourself right. It's about last night.
Well, I would love if you would hit a harmony.
Let me. Okay, ready?
I mean, I got a guitar here. Are you? You're not going to bust out some songs on the tour, are you?
No. No, it's a non-music tour this time around. Yeah. That was fun, though.
That was fun. Well, you were doing that at the end of some of your shows, yeah? Or was it more like in-town stuff when I would see you with the guitar? Like you and Al DeBene on stage?
It was pretty much only local, where I'd be like, just to break things up, let me do something that's, music-related tonight, whether it's music improv songs or whatever. And then when I started doing these massive venues, I felt like oh, you know what? This really is like an encore kind of show closing moment. So maybe I can lean into the rock star side that we all want to be.
Yes.
And I enjoyed that, but it's not part of my regular repertoire of what I bring to the stage.
Well, your material has always been, and this is a handful of questions I've got, but
is it literally a handful? Did you measure it? Did you put all the questions like in some kind of
I wrote
tiny
them down on those
satchel and then you were like, this is like a handful.
Everyone's
of
like
questions.
It seems like two handfuls. No, dude. Is it a barrel? Probably not.
It's like you never know what you're going to learn. You think the questions are going to be more informative, but it's actually measurement.
The measurement of your curiosity.
Okay.
But like, you know, from the get-go.
By the way, we can't kill early because then we're not going to be able to follow ourselves. So let's just pace it.
Podcast speakers are my worst people to listen to, but my favorite cover band of all time.
Okay.
Podcast speakers. Would you ever be in a band, by the way? Would you ever take that Kevin Bacon, Dennis Quaid route of like, you know what? It's time to truly mix things up.
It's time to truly disappear from the zeitgeist.
I'm tired of being in these games that people play on how they're connected to me.
I fucking swirl the drain here. Okay. I would. I had
because you are musical.
I had a band.
You did.
I did. We were called rock band. We were called Vivid Blur. I came up with the name.
Yes.
And that lasted maybe for a couple of months and then literally was like, you know what? I'm putting too much effort into something that I don't have the same understanding of as the comedy thing.
Yeah. There is, though, and like you just mentioned it right up top, like comedians want to be rock stars and rock stars comedians.
Absolutely.
How do you feel about the fact that people said and still say that you made, like you brought that the rock and roll aspect to comedy?
My response to that is, I was like, you ever hear of Dice? I'm like, I felt like, okay, this is how I look at what I implemented into maybe the tried and true formula of Steve Martin and Dice.
Right.
Was, this idea of being a showman, this idea of like amplifying it to be able to play to this large scale crowd. What I felt like I brought to that from seeing those guys and being informed by that, wanting to emulate it, was okay. I'm the next generation of comedy, so I can curtail it and adapt to whatever it is that comedy is today, instead of feeling like I had to just do something that was their formula. So I do think that I brought like my own spin to it, but I don't ever feel like I
took it to the next
created
level.
Created it.
Right.
You know what I mean? I definitely took it to the next level. I took it to some crazy levels.
You did.
I took it to levels that, I could probably put it in a handful. If I were to write them in question form.
You mentioned like wanting to always, was that always your goal to a stand-up, like to, you just said like the larger than life, like playing, having it be able to play to these massive crowds. Like, is that how you always envisioned it? Like seeing the people that you looked up to being like, oh, this doesn't need to just be in a comedy club.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's two responses. There's the version of me that was like, okay, I was, pipe dreaming and seeing these people do these unbelievable, incredible sized venues and kind of like willing it to come to fruition. But then there's something else where I had no spine for a lot of years. I was very weak. I was a very sensitive, I think we might have talked about it before, but I had a lot of anxiety. I had a lot of things that I needed to overcome.
Before stand-up, or as you were getting...
Before stand-up, during stand-up, last week. so I felt like I had a lot of time to dream about like all the things that I didn't really know if I could ever even accomplish. I was like this big dreamer that probably was somehow making the universe cooperate with this idea of, hey, if it starts to work a little bit, that's a huge win for me. If I can get on stage, I did it. I spoke in front of people.
Wow.
I matter to somebody.
Sure.
So once it was like the 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, once it started going, I was like, I'm fucking taking this as far as I can, I'm whatever the size venue is that I can take it to, I'm going to see.
Do you miss MySpace?
Do I miss it? No. No, I don't miss it because I feel like the old bull on the hill now, where I can look down and tell the young bull, like, I was on the internet when it was fun. I had a good 5-year stretch when the internet was like truly, absolutely fun.
Awesome, yeah.
It was great. 5 years. And then like
before true trolls were like,
yes,
where there were so many that it felt like, I think it was I don't know, just spread out to where there was a lot of good and some bad, and but then the commenting just got out of control, and the amount of people that thought, oh, I can post anything, right?
Yes, yeah. For the first 5 years, it was like people were celebrating things that they found on the internet that was far away from them,
yeah,
that they could still love. Hey, this thing that's not even in my region, I love that.
Yeah.
So that's what the internet was at first, a crossroads for all things.
Great movie, by the way.
Absolutely.
Okay. Dan Aykroyd's... isn't that the Britney Spears one?
No, we're talking about one with the fiddle, right? There's two crossroads.
By the way, which one?
I thought
the Britney Spears Dan Aykroyd was the only crossroads movie.
No, things have multiple names. There's like certain books that have the same title. No, there was one where it was like he's playing the devil and he's playing a fiddle. How did this get into the conversation?
It's fine. Look, it was next on my list of questions anyway.
Do you have like people that can look up the IMDb Crossroads?
Norman, Crossroads. I know it's a Bone Thugs and Harmony song.
Yeah,
but
I think it's also a song with a film with Ralph Macchio.
Tell me
if we're right.
I love that.
Who's right? Are we both right? I
hope we're both right.
I like... Okay, you know what? Until you have all the information, let's wait it out, okay? Maybe until you know both answers instead of stigmatizing
home
me.
Court advantage, man.
Putting W's in the win column is what I'm about.
Wait, so there was this crossroads.
It was a 5-year period where it was a blast, and people were just like finding you and celebrating. And then you soaked that up.
You were at the precipice of that,
I was in the center of this newfangled thing.
Did somebody tip you off, or did you just recognize?
Al Gore called me. Al Gore called me personally and said, I just invented this thing called the internet. Get on.
Before the polar bears take it over, get on, use it for your advantage.
Nobody tipped me off, man. I just was a geek, and I loved tech.
You are a tech geek, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I had like early Commodore 64 computers I'd rip apart, or in televisions or what. I just liked computers and soldering. I was a big fan of soldering irons. I was just into that. So when computers started to gain more popularity, I felt like, oh, this is something that I really understand. And I was so socially awkward, and I had so much anxiety, and was such an introvert, that here is a way that I could be with thousands of people millions of miles away in my office.
And communicate in the way that I would want to in person.
Yes. Yeah. If I could be this person all of the time, how gratifying would that be? But I can do it here in sitting in my underwear eating Fruit Loops.
I feel like that's your cereal.
Always.
Yeah.
And forever.
By the way, if that's not the new Fruit Loop slogan, I don't know what they're doing with their marketing.
Fruit Loops.
Always and forever.
And forever.
Like, is this a diamond commercial? I feel like that could be damaging socially if you didn't have that stage outlet to just sit behind and create this persona that you are like, oh, cool, this is what, you know what I'm saying? Like, you are still actively flexing that muscle of just speaking publicly.
Yes.
So that you know what I'm saying? Like, if you're just sitting behind and you were just creating this brand for something else that wasn't performing.
Yeah. Sometimes people who want to give me a little ribbing will be like, but you just cater to this internet. Well, the truth is, you can make all the noising that you want. You can bang two pots together and say, come see me. If you come into the room and that person's not funny, if I didn't deliver, nobody was sticking around.
People
forget that. It wasn't just like, you know, we're going to sit here in this arena. This is terrible. But he did click on the thing that we sent him on the internet. Therefore, we need to come here. Like, fucking ridiculous.
You forget that people have choices.
Right. It's just, it always dialed back to, and trust me, if there was like a short route, I would have liked to have taken it for those formative years too. But really, it was like, I can't tout myself unless I know I can deliver when they come into the room.
How has it, just to speak to that 5-year period where you feel like it was a celebration, how do you feel like it has, and it's a loaded question, but like, you know, because you're still actively using the internet and social media, and it'll probably, all those fans too that really came up in that MySpace era with you are still with you online for Instagram, right? So now how are you trying to reach them still with new ways?
Yeah, I mean, let me give you a loaded answer. Let's both be loaded.
Look, Okay. Loaded questions are best served with loaded answers.
Here's the way I look at it now.
Yeah.
I mean, the internet is... you look at some people, you're like, okay, this person's got 100 million followers, and you know, it's unbelievable when you're that kind of level of branding. But what I see that's so unfortunate for new art, not for me, I already, you know, went through all that stuff. But yeah. When I see new artists that are coming up, what's hard to see is people are so even like uber fickle about clicking the next thing and discovering the next thing that they're not as interested in helping to cultivate what they're already looking at and experiencing.
Right.
So what we're seeing now, without naming names, is we're seeing careers go rapid fire up and then rapid fire out.
Phil Collins. And we're not...
Phil Collins, he's back. He's back. He rested the lower spine. I think he did a couple of pins in there.
He can't drum anymore.
No. His son's on the drums.
We don't need him to drum.
He just sits in a stool and says, in the air at night. But the dee 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 dee. That's no longer Phil.
It can't be. I almost thought I saw Phil Collins at the Grove once. And this guy I go, I never do this, but...
Was he drowning? If you understand what I just put together listening, then you're very, very deep cuts Phil Collins fan.
And I go,
it was something in the air tonight.
Yes. It's okay. Amazing, yeah. I go, Phil, I'm such a big fan, I never do this. And he goes, my name's Alan. And I go, well, now we're both disappointed. I listen to that to him, and then he just goes, what? And I go, dude, you know, you could have, like, said, yeah. If you had just been like, yeah, thanks, great to meet you, and gone on your day, even given me one verse of Susu Studio, now I'm like, I met Phil Collins.
Yeah.
But now I'm just like... Man, fake Phil Collins is a big piece of shit.
He could have put his hand on your shoulder and said, hey, it's just another day for you and me in paradise. and just walked.
Yeah. I know.
Alan, though. You met Alan.
I know. I'm very pumped about
it. You met Alan.
I know. I shouldn't be downplaying that. do you like being on social media? Do you like... I hear some comedians that have... First of all, you're celebrating 30 years, right?
29. Yeah. Unbelievable. Okay. I'll do that too.
Yeah, that's unbelievable. Yes. I was just listening to you with Jeff Ross and you guys talking about stories from getting going and you watching them and to then like, and still be doing it is a really cool thing. You know, I'm 12 years in.
Yeah.
It's really, okay, oh boy. All right. That's right though. That's the amount of applause.
Yeah, no, it's a good amount of time.
But
man.
To hear like you guys still talking about it, in a fun way, is awesome and necessary for people at my level. And to hear you guys be buds and to still also be pushing stand-up and yourselves that much is something I can't truly fathom at this point. Like, I think about how I'm going to be in 5 years from now. And then to add on another 10 on top of that.
Right.
So with social media in the regard of that, there's comedians that are, you know.
And not to interrupt, but it's funny because I'm 29 years in and I still feel like I'm just starting to get good.
For real?
I feel like there's, that. You know, and we can talk about that, you know, leading up to what this tour really is and where I'm at. I honestly, it feels like, oh, all the tools that I assembled, all the things that I failed at and the stuff that didn't work so well informs my stand-up now. So it's like the best of me coupled with being introspective and actually understanding what it means to be like a human being in today's climate, it all informs where the stand-up is now. So it's like the Tom Brady thing. I'm sorry to, you know, it's bring up my Patriots, but it's like,
no, I was gonna get to that.
There's Brady, 41, and it's like he's
just figuring out how to throw a spiral.
Every element that he's experienced, he can now put into. He has that experience that nobody else has out there. He's like Neo in the Matrix, because he's seen every version of every play, so he knows what's happening since memory, which is amazing.
I do want to speak.
Was that a Phil Collins album, Sense Memory?
Right after Truth Dart to the Heart?
It was actually Alan's album.
That would have been great if he was like, actually, I'm sorry that I'm not Phil, but I do have my own band that Dan Cook refused to be a part of. He said it was too close to Vivid Blur's vibe. Your material, too, just in seeing you in the last few months, is like... pretty special right now, man. I'm really
thanks, man.
The timing of this with this tour is like, it got me real fired up for you because like that introspective layer, which I feel like, and you can probably speak to it more so, does take time to become a part of the act, right?
Sure.
Because you have to have I mean, you know, you've done it in other specials to where you've talked about personal things and whatnot.
Right.
But seeing what you were really getting into, like the other night at the factory, I was like, oh man, like this is kind of almost looking straight up looking at all 30 years.
Right.
Versus like just chunks of time.
Yeah. You know? And what I didn't want to, the problem with how I approached this particular chunk of material was, and why it took 3 years. You know, Troublemaker was 3 years ago that I put that out. And
it's one of my favorites, by the way.
Me too. It's like I finally got to generate something from the ground up entirely without anybody impeding on it.
Yeah.
That's true. That's like my painting because I edited it. I paid for it. I wrote it. I sold it. I directed it. So that informed so much because then I was really seeing myself as like more fully fleshed out performer.
Yeah.
So the last few years and why it took a little longer was I was like, I want to be able to have the same level of performance. I don't want to do a one-man show. I don't want to do something that's more maudlin or that loses the LPMs, the laughs per minute.
Yeah.
So it was tricky because I wanted to have all of those things firing off. And I did. I figured it out. I cracked the code and then just was diligent and now we're taking it out on the road.
And this the hour and change, I think you said like you think hour 15 is like the sweet spot.
I think an hour and 15 minute show is really great.
Yeah.
I mean, it's 2 hours of material that I've put together. And I always tell people, like, if you see me a couple nights in a row, it's going to be different.
That's awesome. Oh, so you got 2 hours right now that you're going to be fucking with.
Yes.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. Is that a conscious move before you're doing a tour to have, like, have you ever done a tour where you started and you're like, all right, I got 20 great minutes. Here we go, trying to find the other 40.
Yeah, Rough Around the Edges from Madison Square Garden. I'm telling you the absolute truth, no bullshit. It was at least 70% improvised.
No way.
Yeah, I was shooting Dan in real life.
Yeah.
They wouldn't let me leave to do any club work. We were in a part of Rhode Island that there wasn't much near us. Providence Comedy Connection was kind of far. So I wasn't working out at all, but that date was looming.
But what's funny is that they let Juliette Binoche go do a lot of club dates.
She did, actually. She did my routine, and she crushed it. She Binoche'd it, we say. That's the new...
She Binoche'd it.
Yeah, she Binoche'd it, okay? Like from the three-point line, Binoche'd.
Which, by the way, Billy Ocean is really upset that she took that.
The Caribbean Queen guy?
The Binoche'd it, yeah.
Oh!
It's Billy Ocean. He's like, you Binoche'd, you know. That's a real far stretch. You mind just turning this...
I went with you. I got it. I went down
you
the stretch.
You got in the bit boat.
Yeah. So that was
turn
like...
Turn this up a little bit like this.
And you? So I called it Rough Around the Edges because it was very much Rough Around the Edges. Even all the way down to like, I filmed it, but I didn't do hair. I didn't do makeup. Everything about that thing is like the opposite of Vicious Circle, which was very sleek and very like, you know, like an armor of material I'd crafted. Rough Around the Edges was the version where I'm like, okay, how much of me can just go up there and be... Am I just funny because I can be funny? With any conversation.
Truly trying to test that, huh?
Truly testing it. Didn't always work, but ultimately when I watched that special outside of Troublemaker, it's also one of my favorites because I grew so much from the things that I that I wasn't prepared quite ready for, and then I grew from that.
And that was at Madison Square
Garden? That was Madison Square Garden, yeah.
So you're improvising in the garden.
The whole thing about the flute joke and the whole thing about the Civil War flute player and all that was off the top. All that was like riffed.
I mean, you had some, nuggets
I had
of
opening
things.
And closing were set. And then, and this is kind of how I do my stand-up now anyway. This has been my formula for a long time. This is how I see it. It's like a template or it's like a square. It's like a sandbox. And I have four quadrants, four corners that I know this is very funny about this. This is very funny, this and this on each corner. Okay, so now what I want to do is create an environment where when I hit one of those corners, I know the other corners are going to hit. I know they're funny. I've worked on it enough. I can think. I can really listen to the crowd and sometimes respond almost like it's a conversation and go somewhere else with it. Why? Because I can linger into the middle of the sandbox and I can hit that corner at any point. I have one in and then I have three outs. So it's not necessarily that I got to get to the last punchline the same way every time. It's like, no, any one of these will work to get the hit that I need with what I'm trying to portray, and then I can move on to the next thing. That means that the bit some nights are 8 minutes, and then the next night it might be 14 minutes.
Wow. Are you recording that stuff? Like when you, I mean, how many like bits after, since you were improvising in the special, and a lot of people, I think like yourself too, when you do it in the special, then you kind of retire it more or less?
Sure.
Yeah?
Yeah, definitely.
So, I mean, were you coming up with bits and then being like, oh man, I would love to keep playing with that, because I just came up with it for this special, and there's more to it later, but because I did it there and it's taped and I'm using it.
I think that most of whatever I filmed for that, I didn't end up cultivating anymore. Wow. I kind of just felt like it belonged there. Yeah, and
it happened there.
Yeah.
Do you even have nuggets, like for the whole Civil War flute thing, were there even like things you had thought about previous?
Oh, yes.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, right, you're not just...
This is how... this.
Like, I'll take a suggestion from the arena. Civil War flutes! Yeah.
When I was in my sophomore year of high school,
yeah.
Ready? This is how weird our brains are as comedians. This is where the joke came from. I went to a vocational school to learn graphic design for 1 year before I switched to another school to do drama. In that 1 year, there was a food court in the vocational tech cafeteria area. It was called the Fife and Drum Grill. The word Fife, every day when I would see it, it like fascinated me.
Yeah.
It's just such a different... Who would call their place the Fife and Drum? So I learned what a fife is. I learned it's flute. But we just decided to go, hey, let's start calling a fife a flute. It's time. We
enough
fife
was enough.
For fucking years.
We're we going owe it flute. To ourselves.
Yeah. So Fife and Drum Grill was in my head. And over the years, I would think about the Fife and Drum Grill.
That's
and I
amazing.
Would,
just I would, hold on to it.
I would hold on to it. And I would think about like a person playing the fife. I would think about a person playing the drum. And then it all started to come to me. Probably weeks before I even did Madison Square Garden, like, oh, I see a bit where I could probably do, like, what was it like to be the fife guy and the drum guy back during the Civil War when all your buddies have guns and I got to do this with a fife? And the word fife is just funny to it's say. The whole bit, stream of consciousness came in that moment of, like, I segued into it, like, hey, have you ever seen an old Civil War photo? That was the material.
Yeah.
That was the actual written part.
Gotcha.
That was done. That was the laugh. Hey, have you seen, why do they always look so stoic?
Yeah.
Nobody knew smile back then. Everybody just looked like they just passed away and their body was like going through the... And so that worked. And then I just ramped it up and went into the fife and drum thing based on something I saw in sophomore year of high school.
Oh my God.
Yeah. It still happens, man. Still like a lot of my sets, that's kind of... I don't write material. I don't sit and think of things during the day. It comes to me. And then when I explore, why did I think that? I'm always pleasantly surprised at, like, oh, I remember seeing a couple fight and say, just get the jelly. You know, I remember seeing that one time. And That's amazing. Like, it sticks in my head. And I'm like, what a funny thing to say during a fight. Just go get the jelly, twat. You know?
Wait, twat was in there too?
No, I think I butted it with...
Yeah,
it just needed... Just get the jelly is what I actually heard.
God, that's what grocery store is that at?
I think it was at Avon's Pavilions. I call up the whole thing.
It's the crew that roams around the Avon's Pavilion is definitely, there's a lot of angst.
Yeah.
Couples aren't happy there.
Yeah, it's almost like you go into Avon's Pavilions and it's like going from Winterfell to King's Landing, aisle to aisle.
Do you think it's synonymous to being active, to be getting on stage, and also being conditioned to be coming up with material? Like you're saying, like, you don't sit down and write stuff, but if something does hit you, knowing that you're either, you have shows coming up or you're going to get on stage that night, do you think that makes your brain see things a little bit, lock in a little bit harder?
Yeah, and for me, I've always felt like it all comes back to improv, you know, starting off in a sketch group and improv group. You know, we came up with our funniest stuff usually just out there when we were winging it.
Yes.
And so I always have to have an element of winging it. I always have to have spontaneity
and commitment. And I know that you've spoken, like, those are the guys that you love and looked up to, the guys that just went 100%. For it.
Yeah. You got to be, like, you know, locked and loaded and ready to perform. But I've always, and I still strive to be a performer that can be observational and introspective. I just want both of those to mesh. And so where the material is now, which is fun, and if you've seen it recently, is like, I'm telling you something that happened to me. I have like this crazy stalker story. I'm telling a story about this stalker, but I'm finding beats in there that are about life happening outside and then back to my story and then the beats.
Wow.
So I'm finding fragments of observational humor, tried and true.
Yeah.
And I'm mixing it into my introspective life.
I mean, that sounds like the best combo for... the best place to be.
Yeah, that's why I'm going out, man. I wouldn't, you know, I don't go out there until I know it's ready. You've been on tour with me. It's like, unless I know that it's really ready for public consumption, I'm just not going
to
go.
How do you know that? Does it take one, like, do you have to have one special night at the factory or the store or whatever to go, all right, it's time?
You know who will tell you your material's ready? This is like the little secret of comedy.
Yeah.
The waitresses.
Really?
Yeah. The waitresses know.
Because
the waitresses, they see everybody and everything.
Forget that. You just think like, no, they have no time to listen. Oh, they're putting drinks down.
They are the eyes and ear. They're like the little finger. I'm going to keep it on a Game of Thrones. They know everything.
Spoiler alert.
And so they, I know, you haven't seen it yet, but you're going to love it.
Little finger. I think a little foot from Land Before Time. No, the two worlds mesh.
You're going to love to hate him.
Okay.
Anyway, so, and the waitresses will, actually, if you talk to them, will tell you like, you know, hey, oh my God, that's that. Oh, I remember when that was just kind of like amusing and that, oh, that story. So you start to feel, and then truly just comedians. I've had comics coming up to me, comics that like I don't even have like a deeper rapport with, more than just, you know, saying hello as we pass in the night.
Yeah, yeah.
Saying to me like, hey man, that bit, that the thing about the missing girl, that's done, dude. You got to do that.
Wow. That's it. Isn't that it for a comedian, right?
Yeah, you validation. Start, yeah. You know, from as hardcore as we can be to each other and competitive, yeah, and it can be a prickly environment. It's still the opinion that matters so much when your, you know, comedian friends are like, you killed it, man. You crushed it. That was amazing.
Even for a guy like you that has, that, you know, done and accomplished, I've, you know, from looking at it from the outside, everything that you could want to as a comedian. But you still, that part doesn't go away, right? Because you're a human being and you're, and the feeling of trying out new stuff and, and wanting to feel like you're always growing and not getting stagnant. So you still, you want that.
I still want that. I need it. I need that. And also, I need to be able to do that for other performers. As I've gotten a bit older, it's like, I've got mentors. I've had great mentors. Well, now I need to be able to say to comics, I mean, outside of comedy, I talk to artists as well, but like, just speaking of comedians, I've been through hell and back. I've gone through every facet of the machine. I've seen every side of it. I've seen the deplorable side. I've seen the side that's actually a beautiful artistry, an amazing environment to create in. So now I can impart all that, because you know what? I have nothing to gain. I have nothing to gain from you, or nothing that I could lose necessarily. I just want to be able to now regurgitate all these things that have happened to me, so you can go, oh shit, maybe that helps me with what I'm trying to create.
Does your girl, who is an amazing musician and so sweet,
oh thank you,
and I've seen her at so many shows,
yeah,
and what is really cool is to see her watch, and you know, with not a critical eye, but like enjoying and laughing and loving it all. But then, you know, and I remember one time even talking to her about a bit where I was like, oh, that, I haven't seen that. And she's like, yeah, and he had added that, blah, blah. It seems like it's whatever. She was very, you know, articulate about discussing it, which I thought was really cool. How has that influenced your comedy?
It's for the first time in, well, not for the first time, like meaning today, but for the past maybe 5 years, I've just been the happiest that I've been all around in life. I don't know if people really understand. When I hit superstardom, I didn't know how to handle that. I didn't really know what that was. There's no playbook for that. And then imagine you're there and you're reveling in it as a young person. Yeah. And then I'm going to go down to not only the bottom on the other side of the mountain, but I'm going to go lower into the dark abyss of losing my parents, both of them getting sick, my brother pulling a fast one on me.
And in the same year, right?
Same year. And then going into stuff with, you know, the whole CK thing.
Yeah.
It was like 3 years of just anomaly stuff that I wasn't prepared for. So once I worked through all that, and by the way, it always informed my stand-up comedy, but once I finally made it through like the third act of whatever that period was, the real joy of performing came back, but now coupled with the dark minutia that belongs in there as a comedian. So now when Kelsey comes out and sees my show, it's like I finally feel like I'm sharing my life as something more entire than just like a comedian who's successful, which that identified who I was for years.
Yeah.
But that's not how you want to live.
Right.
So now I'm sharing it with somebody who like is very genuine, kind, and supportive.
Did you feel during those, and we don't have to speak to it too much, but during that time that you felt was like below the abyss, how much did you, because I know you took a little break from the stage for a minute, right? And obviously, like, but then, you know, for me, when I've had stuff and nowhere near that, but like things that, you know, get you real low for yourself, that you're sometimes the stage is the only thing that will make me feel better.
Right.
Because I'm like, it's a distraction. It's and not that I'm going to talk about it. It's just cathartic in a way. Yes. I can't explain. But then there are times where I'm like, I physically, nothing is funny in my head or about, you know, and then I've gone up thinking that and it's changed. So yeah. Did you have a need to get up on stage, or was it just too much to process and you're like, I need to, as a human being, like sit this one out?
There were times when I felt like I needed it, and probably because it's all I knew that would make me feel safe. When my dad passed away, I was back in LA for one day. I had to leave him, fly back to do some contractual obligation. And when he passed away, 3 hours later, I went to the Laugh Factory and I performed. I felt like that's what he loved business. He loved seeing this. And I think that more than anybody, he understood, like, hey, if you have a place that you have to be, and that's a proud man thing to go and do your job.
Yeah.
For what I needed at that point, and then what the stage gave back to me in terms of just feeling, you know, the dopamine, you know, going off in your brain and feeling good again. Although it was going to be, you know, a long healing process with that. Doing stand-up constantly at that point was good. Now, there's other times in my life, the past few years, it's like stepping away sometimes has actually been better for perspective.
Yeah.
So I try to, you know, I still try to get on enough to keep me sharp, but I don't want to overdo it, because my process is I want to get it pretty quickly, and then I want to do it. I never want to do it again. I want to talk about something new.
How did you pick all these dates for the tour? Because it's insane, and I don't know if you've actually looked at the schedule. Have you seen your own tour?
I've seen the schedule, and it's, you know.
Listen, I mean, you know, these venues, and you've always, the Masonic in San Fran is like, have you been there before?
Never.
So, because a lot of, I mean, the Wang in Boston, holy shit.
Yeah, been there, never done it.
My scene in Ghostbusters was at that theater.
Oh, wow.
I can't believe we haven't talked about that yet. Yeah, and oh wow, that was the response too when people saw it, because it was a blink. The Chicago Theater, St. Louis, the Stifled, the DC, the Constitution Hall, mm-hmm. the Palace Theater in Albany.
Just great comedy venues.
Orpheum,
man.
In Madison, holy shit, dude. And then Radio City, you're ending it there.
Pretty much, yeah.
Fuck, dude. Mm-hmm. Do you still also enjoy, like, you know, well, first of all, tell me, you know, for me at 12 years, I love it, you know, like I can't get enough of stand-up and the every part of the grind that comes with it, the good nights, the bad nights, the nights where you, like a couple nights ago where I, you know, was opening at the store and Rogan was back there for the first time, I think, seeing me. And I've had a lot of nice pleasantries and conversations in the parking lot. And it was a fun set early, working some stuff out, and definitely saw him like, critiquing in a way that I was not pumped on. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, and I got kind of bummed about that.
Yeah.
But then I was like, well, let's fuel the fire. And now I'm just going to write more that night and get up the next night a couple times more. But the traveling part, do you still love that?
The traveling part?
Of the tour.
I do. It's like once I'm there, I feel better.
Yeah.
I still sometimes am more anxious off stage. In terms of just like feeling social and stuff like that. So I like to, I like walking into a gig and then I go right up. I don't really like too much hang time.
I always saw that about you at the Factory. You would come in right before you had to go up and then just go up. And I started doing that because, man, that is a sweet way to, I mean, you don't have enough time to fully like read what's happening out there. And also sitting and letting your energy drop is a bummer, yeah?
Yeah, and it's also like, if you're listening to too much show, you start to second guess yourself. Maybe they're not going to like this. Maybe they're not going to. I'd rather be like, I don't know what just happened before me. I just know that I'm walking in and have to be the best at what I'm doing for myself right now. So it's also good because then you're conditioning yourself to just be solid every time, not based on, oh, this guy just took the air out of the room. What do I do?
Right. Are there certain cities you've never played on this tour? Or have you covered?
Yeah. I mean, it's like I've played every state, but there are definitely spots that, you know, Adam, you got to realize I went, you know, for many years I was doing clubs, and then I did colleges everywhere all the time. And then
that's when you started, right? You were just college. Yeah, I mean,
that's it. Yeah. All New England is, there's so many schools within close proximity.
Yeah.
So I'm doing these college gigs. I'm building up this college crowd. And then it got so enormous that I kind of skipped theaters and went to these arenas.
That's right.
And stadiums and stuff.
That's right. When I heard somebody say, like, you know, maybe it was Jeff that was asking you about going like from stadiums and now, and he didn't sound like it was a downgrade, but going back to theaters. And I was like, I don't think I've, I think this is the first time he's hitting like a lot.
I didn't
of
say I was playing Burger King. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
Well, I get why people, I get why people of think course. That, you know what I mean? They're going to come back. You're not doing Madison Square Garden, which by the way, you know what I would say to that? If I want to do Madison Square Garden again, I will do everything I need to prime up for an event that is Madison Square Garden.
Yeah.
But what I'm doing now to play, again, let's use the Beacon. I think it's 5,500, is it? That is an amazing place to be centered with that many people, but still be able to be, again, introspective.
Yeah.
To have your pacing, hit your moments when you need the energy or whatever the character is that you're trying to put together.
Yeah.
But to be able to have those beats where you don't have to be on for the guy in the balcony in row Z, it's better.
Yeah.
It's actually better. There's still, you know, Sebastian just did Madison Square Garden.
Oh, yeah.
It's like what he's doing now, that's, I get it. That plays to that. He's doing that event level style in attitude. It works. His brash, you know, bravado and blah, blah, blah. So I can look at somebody like that and understand why they want to play that size venue and what that means both as a performer and also monetarily as a businessman. That's good for business.
Yeah.
Playing more seats is more, you know, cash at the end of the day.
Yeah.
But as just a straight performer, I subscribe to the Rolling Stone method. Stadium, little dinky club, arena, you know, back alley, you know, speakeasy spot. They'll play anywhere.
Right.
They'll play anywhere. And I respect that. And that's kind of what I want my career to be. I want to be able to like dip into any kind of venue and play it.
There was an intimacy to the Beacon that was like almost overwhelming. Like how big that could be, but how it didn't feel like I had to.
You did amazing. And you know what? And that was one of those things where when you're early on in a show and you're getting huge laughs like that, like off the bat, that tells me backstage, I'm like, oh man,
this crowd's great.
This crowd's already fired up.
Yeah.
You know, and my fans are comedy fans. People think they're whatever, like a Dane Cook fan is. It's actually, they just love comedy. They love stand-up comedy, my fans.
Is there, do you have to actively try to, and again, with social media, like trying to continue the reach and connection with people that, I mean, again, when you were at the precipice of building a social media following, like, do you ever think like, oh, there's people that, and people probably comment all the time and send you messages like, I've been following the whole time. Like, does anyone ever say like, could you do more of this? Like, cause this, I've been used to this. And or do people just understand like, no, things.
No,
like,
I've gotten every kind of critique or somebody wants to opine and tell me their perspective. The thing that resonated way more than anything this last year. I did like an underground version of the tour.
Yeah.
You know, my fans are honest. They're comedy fans. They always tell me who they like. They always want to share, you know, oh, I saw this guy also, and then your show and blah, blah, blah. So it's always like guys and girls that they dig.
Right.
And then they'll be honest with me about like a certain special or something that they saw. They've always been outspoken. And I don't mind that, even if they like Vicious Circle more than this or whatever. But the results from last year are what made me immediately put the tour together for this year, because people that had seen me multiple times would write me and say, or meet and greet and say, I saw you at Madison Square Garden, then I saw you at that gig down in Tampa, and I actually saw you earlier at a blah, blah, blah. This was my favorite show you've done.
Wow.
And when I started hearing that, Adam, I was like, okay, you know what? I gotta charge this. And not just a few people, like the diehard long-term fans were coming back and saying like, please put this out as a special. Is this going to come out at some point, or where can we see this?
How much of that can you listen to? Like, because I mean, I'm starting to get a little bit of that, not even in the same numbers, but where people see certain shows and then comment, and I'm like, yeah, maybe. And it is funny how you take into account like somebody that, you know, that you've never met or whatever, but they have been following. So they're like, man, that was it or whatever. And I'm like, maybe that was it, Alan, you know?
Well, Alan.
Yeah.
I just look at it as I don't, it's not one particular voice that I can say, that swayed me in a certain direction. But when I'm getting, you know, multitudes of people coming and being like, hey man, you know, I love this. I love this show. And saying, to be honest, like, I didn't think it would be as good. You exceeded my expectations, which you already exceeded last time at that blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. So you're fine with that, right?
Oh man, dude, I'm at the top. Listen, seeing a new act and supporting somebody that's coming up the ranks is super exciting, and it's valuable, you know, obviously to that young artist to build up their fan base. There's another side of that. Seeing somebody at a pedigree from the years of experience under their belt with way more tools in their arsenal, seeing that show, and I've seen a lot of shows like that. I've gone to a lot of, you know, shows where you've seen somebody at their peak, and then you're seeing them over here, and they're better. And you're like, oh my God, this is like, it's part of the evolution, you know?
Yeah.
It's just part of the I feel like where I'm at now, maybe it's because I'm at my happiest, but I feel like the material is at its best.
That's so great, yeah. Dude. You can tell. There's a joy that you mentioned.
Totally can
about
tell. I'm my worst critic. I would be the first person to be like, eh.
How do you assess a set when you get off? Like, if you don't have a good time, is that first and foremost? Or do you go right to, like, when I saw you the Factory and you get off, I'm always curious because then you're in your head right away, right, about like what happened, or do you kind of let yourself sit for a minute and let it
marinate a bit? Yeah. Sometimes for me, it's like I won't really reflect on it until a couple of days later, but if it's like something I'm working on, like I really want to button up this bit tonight or in the next couple, you know, I need something here. Then I'm thinking about it when I get off stage. But for the most part, it just feels right to continue to, you know, chip away at it. And then if it's really meant, I feel like it's done in some way when I am so excited to start the bit still. You're not as excited to start a bit sometimes. You'll feel yourself like when you know you're going into something that might be lumbering or you're like, here we go. Here's the thing about Alan, right? And you have to amp yourself up. When you're going into a bit being like knuckles crack and going, oh my God, this thing's about to fly. That's when I know.
Right.
That's when I know. The first 30 seconds of the intro to the next piece of material, when I'm feeling like really amped up, that's when I know it's ready.
Is there, are you going to come up with a new, like a Sufi finger?
No,
that's done with.
No, I did. You know, the saddest part, I created a logo for myself.
It was incredible.
It was incredible. It was
brilliant.
Until people got it tattooed on their body. And then I was like, don't do that. I may not use this forever.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was like, it was a bit of a fad in my life, but it was fun. It was definitely something that, like,
but that's part of that connecting with the fan base that you can't even explain.
They helped me to make this thing, and we did it together. But at this point, no, it's not so much. If I'm going to create anything, it's not so much about like a logo or something. It's like content.
Yes,
it's like a film or something I want to direct or produce or stand up. That's where all the energy goes into.
How often do you think back to when you're doing gigs or even just doing podcasts or anything? Like, do you reflect on the early days, and then how much of that actually pops in? Like, do you have a favorite Dan Cook bit?
A favorite
from like coming up, or do people? Because I'm sure you're still getting messages about, like, you know, people just even giving you long
diatribes. The speak and spell bit,
yeah,
was like a life-changing, weirdly enough, bit,
right?
Because I thought of it in eighth grade. I already had the joke in my mind in eighth grade because of the voice, and I would do the voice in my house and be silly about it. And then when I started doing open mic, I told the story that would eventually be fleshed out for the Harmful of Swallowed and everything.
Right.
I took it to New York. Now we're talking about like three, four years later, and Zoe Friedman saw me do the bit at the Boston Comedy Club, which is near the Cellar in the Village. And based on that bit, I got Letterman.
Yeah.
And I
you built did it on Letterman,
whole,
right?
Yeah. Yeah. I built the whole set around it, like a novelty set, things that we remember about our youth. And then that got me colleges. That got me. So that bit that I thought of in eighth grade really was like,
oh my God.
Ushered me into some places of success.
Do you remember saying it to somebody and hearing them laugh and then going, oh, cool, there's something there. Because in eighth grade, I can't even, I mean, I remember like making buddies laugh and stuff, and you still can't have a recognition of like, right, doing something, an impression or a story or a bit, and then people laugh and to then internally go, oh shit, there's something there.
Yeah.
Is a crazy thing to
have. It
was
the opposite for me.
Oh. Boy, you ever seen Katie Couric just swing and a miss during interviews? But it doesn't happen. But if it were.
You are the Katie Couric of podcasting. Everyone says it, Adam. I sat my mom and sister Kelly down, and I'd been doing open mics, and I wanted to do the bit. And so I sat them in the living room, and I was like, you know, holding a vase or whatever, a hairbrush, and doing the. So I did that. And they literally sat there and looked at me. They had pretty good senses of humor, especially my mom. They looked at me. And then finally I was like, what'd you think of that bit? And I remember my mom, she went, oh, baby, I don't think that's funny. She was like, I just don't know. I love your physicality, but I don't. Like, it immediately bombed in front of my family.
Fuck.
Yeah, but I did it anyway. And then, of course, years later, my mother was like, it's still not my favorite, but...
But mom, it bought you this. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think that very early on for me with stand up, it really was more about how I felt internally that dictated what I should be talking about or doing, as opposed to like a lot of outside opinions about that. You know what I mean?
Did you always have such an innate ability to break down and showcase and highlight?
Let's just stop at breakdown. yes. I pulled over on the side of the Mass Pike once, and I remember I cried viciously. I don't know. Have you ever cried viciously? It's where the it's where the tears are rushing and pulling your skin.
Yeah.
That's how sad you are. It's so where the slow, breakdowns, I understand.
It's where the slow R&B song actually stops mid-chorus to like break the fourth wall and check in on you through the radio, because they're like, are you okay?
Listen, some go R&B. I go Savage Garden when I'm feeling those tears starting to come.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, you're a true child of the 90s. But the car accident bit.
Yeah.
Like that.
I wrote it right over here. I wrote it.
That to me is like, I mean, look, there's a lot. And again, when I was thinking about this the other day, where I go, what is my favorite bit of that comedian's? Dude, there aren't a ton where people can go, I love that so-and-so bit. You got so many of those. And again, to equate it to like rock star having hits, that is a crazy thing to me, to where someone goes, I love this bit. And then to have multiples of those.
Yeah, to have people still coming up and quoting lines from material that I couldn't perform now, I don't even remember, is like the most flattering part, because as kids, we were doing the same thing, quoting Eddie Murphy and quoting Steve Martin. So it's wonderful.
The car accident bit had so many levels and layers to it and was so, again, brilliantly depicting what happens and things you don't like, even just the people that pretend to be cold and shivering,
right?
It's fucking, that happens every time, and you never think of those details.
Yeah, so, I was living on the corner of Crescent Heights and Fountain out here, we're in Los Angeles, and that was the year that I was living there. USA Today came out with this top 10 worst intersections in the country, most dangerous, dude. And it was like number 4. Because was my intersection. I was on the corner. I was literally on the southwest corner in that building, the big manor-looking building in that corner.
Jesus, yeah.
And every night, I hear... Because people would come down the hill, and you didn't know that your 30-mile-an-hour actually turned into 65. Yeah. And so every night, there was car accidents. Like, almost every single night, there was some kind of screeching, and then several nights, you'd wait for it, like, the bit.
Yeah.
And then when you'd hit, you'd be like, ooh, gotta get out there, gotta go. And I rush out.
Fuck, I'm going without shoes.
Every time there was an accident for the year plus before I even did it as a joke, I'd just go out there and I would just watch. That, oh, there's always somebody that likes to talk to the cop. Somebody wants to talk to the guy who got in the accident. Oh, there's always the person acting cold. There's always the person wanting to let you know what they were doing when it happened. I was in my kitchen. I was washing a dish and I heard it. So I came out. And it was always same phrasing.
The fact that that person retells that story as if that's now the hot button issue.
Yeah, that's like people saying what they were doing when 9/11 happened, but they weren't anywhere near the towers. Right?
It's like,
I was in Tampa.
And the Notebook had just come out, and I was going, or was it on DVD? Either way, I was excited to see it. I hadn't seen it, and it was one of those things where everyone had been saying, you gotta see it, and I remember that being the day where I was like, I'm finally gonna see it.
Right? It's like...
That's insane.
I just wanted... I observed and reported with that piece of material, so I think that... I think if I had to pick any material early, say early on, because I have stuff now that I really love and I'm hoping to, you know, share with people on the next tour.
Oh, yeah.
But when I look back at the cheating bit, the first time I did that, and it was on Comedy Central, and the whole part about the putting the key in, you just cheated, you're coming home from cheating, and then you put the key, I said, and it's like your keyhole's in stereo, because it's like this loud. And then I talked about the floors creaking. This is all stuff that I did. I was I was a dirt bag. I cheated on this girl that I was with, and then I was studying myself, going, oh, these are all the things that I did, and then I'm going to put it into a piece of material. So probably one of my favorite early bits, because I was introspective at a time when I didn't have a lot of that.
Right. That's insane. Yeah, that is a, I mean, look, there's, you know, things that we all, you know, you want to hone up.
I've been around so long, I have vintage bits. That's fucking weird, man.
It is, right? Are there people that come to shows now that you... you know, that your fans, obviously, like your Patriots, your Celtics, like you've gotten to go to so many, the Sox, obviously, like be a part of so many like amazing things. And it feels like they've definitely like welcomed you with open arms through all that, which is what I think any comic who loves sports wants. Yeah. Like all I'm waiting for is for the Seahawks or Mariners to just be like, dude, come raise the flag or throw out the pit. Like just sit with the owners and like tell us what you think we could do better.
Right.
But are there people that are still coming out?
They've never asked me that, by the way, but God, do I wish. Dane, just write our playbook. Here's a marker. It's X's and O's. Just how do we run this?
Is it? Does it get boring to keep winning Super Bowls?
Listen, man, there was a lot of lean years in Boston where people don't realize that. We were coming up. Okay, after the blizzard of 78, it was bad. And then the Red Sox had the curse, and the Patriots were really, really funky for a while.
People forget that.
We had the Celtics. Yeah, and, you know, we had Bird, and we had some great years. You know, we went up against the, you know, the Lakers. So we had a little bit of fun, but it wasn't anywhere near what we've been, the embarrassment of riches that we're entitled to today.
Were you even excited for this Super Bowl?
I was.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I was. I was excited because I wanted to see this guy, you know, Tom Brady, do something that was kind of in the never been done before business.
I feel like he's just like getting real greedy with the amount of winning that is possible at his level and age. And I feel like when he's like, I'll play till I'm 50. Right.
He didn't say 50, though.
He might have said 60. This guy... And he's like, I do this crazy diet, you know, and that's how
he
sounds.
Sandler?
No, that's how he sounds. No.
You just dipped into a little Sandler. He eat a crazy diet. I can't do it really.
No one does a good Tom Brady. I don't think there is one. But
that was not a good Tom Brady. That was Sandler.
Yeah. He just feels like that he wants to test what the human body is truly capable of.
Yeah, I think that he...
And he should, right?
I think he's
just competitive. We get a handful of athletes, and again, if you were to take all the athletes... that are capable of this and put them in a hand, there'd be a few.
Yeah, he's at a place now where he's like Neo at the end of the Matrix.
Yeah.
He has seen everything. He's so much more further along than most of the guys out in that field that certain movements, before he even needs to really ponder it, sense memory is telling him, I've seen this before. This happened in my life, you know, 10 years ago. So I feel like he's playing at just an entirely different level. If his body can, you know, keep up with him, then I think that he could play for a bunch more years. But I don't know about 50, but...
50 more years?
No.
Oh, at age 50. Yeah. I was like, I don't think anyone knows about 50 more
years. Can you imagine he played 50 more years?
Who's going to be our first 100-year-old Super Bowl champ?
Tom Brady.
It's got to be.
If it was going to be anybody, it would be him.
Have you met him?
Yeah. In fact, my favorite sports story was I did a charity event with him 3 summers ago. Best Buddies.
Oh, yeah.
They do Best Buddies in Boston. Yeah. And so, and they do it actually in other regions. But
I want to comment on that real quick. You've always been really great about charity work and shows.
Yeah, as long as I'm getting paid.
Let me finish. Yeah, the dollar amount was always appropriate.
I'm kidding. Yeah, no money there. Yeah. Just an incredible organization. And of course, anytime you can give back, using your comedy in a way that's going to, like, it's just the win-win.
Yeah.
So I'm doing the charity football event with him, and he's QBing for both teams. So the other team's beating us, and it's the last drive of the game, but we're down. We're down by, they kicked a field goal. He's QBing for both teams.
Oh, shit.
So he just plays, everybody gets to play with Tom. Last play of the game, clock's running out. He throws it to a little kid that's like 10 feet away from me. This kid, I'm not going to let him get the ball. I chuck him out of the way. I pick six off Brady. I run past Tom, and literally I'm laughing, and I take it into the end zone. And then I bring the ball back. I go, dude, you got to sign this right now. I can't tell you what he said to me. It was kind of funny. But he signed the ball, and it's in my living room. So I pick six off Tom Brady.
Holy shit.
Yeah, my greatest sports moment. Yeah, and then I retired right after.
Yeah.
They, my number went up at a local pizzeria.
Did you have jobs before stand-up?
Like, I did.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was a dietary aide at a nursing home.
For real?
I did that, yeah. I was 16, 17 years old. You know, feeding elderly people. And I was in charge of pureeing. I was in charge of, like, pureeing food, like a steak, so they could drink it out of a cup. Some of them couldn't eat, like, solid food.
That's amazing.
So I did that for a while. And then I worked at a video store. I worked at a pizza place. I had a newspaper route, and I plowed snow. I almost died plowing snow. This was kind of crazy. There was a huge lake in Medford, Massachusetts, called the Mystic Lakes. And every winter, cars would drift off the road on the black ice, and they would go onto the Mystic Lake and then go through the lake. And so people would, it was like, it was just, you stayed away from the Mystic Lakes when it was winter. So I was in a snow plowing team, me and these other seven guys.
There's always a team, right?
Always a team.
Yeah.
If it's one person, you're just doing like individual homes, but like we were like doing supermarket, like Vaughn's Pavilions.
Yeah.
And so,
a lot of land.
Which back east is called Stop and Shop.
Yeah.
So we, at 3 a.m, would go to do these parking lots that we would need to clear for the next morning's business. So we drive into Boston, we do all the cleaning, and then on the way home, I'm the very last, I'm the caboose on this line of plows. Well, the lead guy decides to take the Mystic Lakes. It's been snowing. Obviously, we just plowed all this snow. We're coming around the corner. Everybody else is, you know, moving along great. I'm the last one. I started to come around the bend. The entire plow starts to, like, pirouette in the most, like, smoothest possible way. And then it picked up speed. I couldn't stop. I couldn't do anything. And it went off the road, and I immediately went down the snowy embankment, and I'm heading toward the Mystic Lake. It's like 15 feet away from me.
Oh, shit.
And something inside of me, because I couldn't stop. I was, you know, hitting the brakes, but I'm sliding on the snow.
Yeah, yeah.
Something inside me, a voice was like, just fucking drop the plow. And so I hit the crank, and I basically broke this plow. And the whole plow went and went into the dirt as I was going onto the lake. And it stopped me right at the lake.
Oh, my
back tires were on the lake. And the plow had dug in so much. Now, of course, the guy who owned the company is like, you fucked up my plow. Yeah. He was so pissed. I go, I was about to die, man.
Yeah.
I was about to die. So I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. And I'm going to do stand-up comedy because I think it's safer.
Holy shit.
That was like one of my last jobs that I had. I was doing all those at once to make ends meet.
There's probably somebody out there, too, that saw that and told some sort of authorities later and was like, yeah, no, I was inside. I was listening to Phil Collins' Greatest Hits, and I went out and I saw, and he almost went into the river.
I love what you just did. Yeah. I appreciate that so much, man.
I mean, I appreciate
you,
man.
The art of the callback, nobody really understands.
I know, you do.
It's a gift.
It
is. Not everybody can do that.
Your acting is on point.
Okay.
And I know you're... Okay.
Yeah, I accept that.
Yeah. You're taking on like cooler and cooler roles, I feel like. And I don't know if that's something that you're seeking out. Remind me of the space movie that I remember when I watched it for the, not space movie, the when you guys were quarantined. The title again?
Right. It was called 400 Days.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Awesome.
Yeah, really. Psychological thriller.
Yeah, dude. That's
something very different.
For any actor, and especially comedian actor, like something like that is just totally different,
right?
And you crush that.
Oh, cool.
And I was like, oh, okay, like, you know, your chops had already been proven, but like that's, you know, that's way different than Good Luck Chuck.
Yeah, it definitely way different. And also I was starting to be approached by people to executive produce stuff,
right?
Which, you know, sometimes people go, oh, is that just a title you get to be in the movie? It's like, no, sometimes you're actually part of the casting and the entire creative process.
Did you enjoy that?
I did.
Yeah,
I did, so much so that It informed how I wanted to continue with my career, which was like, okay, at the center is always going to be stand-up because I love it. I love it, you know? I love it like I loved it the very beginning. I love it like that again, the same way. But I like collaborating with people. I don't like being as isolated as I used to in the world of comedy.
Right.
I don't want to be ostracized from people. I want to work with people. So it's I'm producing another film that I'm going to actually also co-star in. It's a murder mystery.
Dope.
We're doing it next year with a company that did the film I just did that Lionsgate picked up that's going to put out next year. This year, called American Exit.
Yeah.
So just more dramatic stuff and things that are off kilter and away from the stand-up tone.
I was curious where my, and you said you being a part of the casting process, I sent at least 7 tapes in for 400 days. You truly banoshed me by not, okay. just looking for another banosh.
You got it.
Is there something about acting that, I mean, obviously like they're different beasts like stand-up and acting, but is there something about being on set and having multiple takes and being a part of a collaborative process like that that does get you excited more so than stand-up, or are they just so...
Yeah, I think different, not more so, but what it means to me is when you feel like you're a piece of a puzzle that a director is trying to put together, and you're actually trying to get their vision, their act, you know, to work.
Yeah.
There's something that's so gratifying about knowing, okay, you and I are in a scene together. We need to, it's got to seem seamless. We need a synergy. We need a realness. It's not just me because I'm prepared. And that's like, that's hard to get. That's hard to get a whole bunch of people that everybody's going to be so simpatico at that point that you can accomplish telling an amazing story that's not you, not your life, not anything to do with you, or maybe not even in your time period. So for me, the exploration of all of those things, and maybe you find that in acting as well, yeah, is like it's kind of a necessity for me. I definitely want to continue to try to, you know, make films and do things like that.
Where does your where's your love for words come into play in all this?
My,
did that
my,
happen in eighth grade?
My love for vernacular.
There it is.
If I may,
your verbiage is at a people don't use verbiage enough.
People don't use verbiage. People don't use jargon.
Jargon's a great one.
It's a great one.
Okay. Do you have a list
word of
words?
The day, that, screensaver. I do.
What is your screensaver?
I actually do have a crazy screensaver that's got, like, you know, extemporaneous and words that, like, yeah, aren't commonly used. I also read a book called, I think it was called 100 Words No One's Using But Should.
Love
just
that.
Different way, you know, different words, ways to describe. What happened to me was this. My dad was a wordsmith. Cool. He used to read the dictionary. I thought he was a total weirdo. I didn't have that same... my education level and what I was focused on was not, I like drama. I, yeah, liked, you know, creative writing. So I'm seeing this with my dad, and then I do 10 years of stand-up comedy. I record my first album, and when I listened to it the first time, the raw version of Harmful Swallowed, I said fucking like 60 times. When we finally edited it, it was so distracting. And what I learned listening to myself in that moment was, I need to build out my ability to paint verbal pictures with words, because I still wanted to have, my parents had truck drivers' mouths. They both said F-bombs all the time.
Yeah.
I still wanted to have that because that's part of me.
Yeah.
But I wanted to be able to tell a story without that word specifically taking you out of it, because I'm saying it so much.
Yeah.
So I wanted the real estate around that word to be like, I'm using it in the right place at the right, for the right thing.
Yeah.
And then I want to be able to use other words to help enhance storytelling.
Yeah, to where it's accenting. I feel like there is value if yeah, it's accenting a certain moment or
absolutely
sentence, or, yeah.
I don't think that there should be any there's definitely not any kind of barrier that somebody should put on themselves in terms of like, oh, I need to be a clean comic or whatever. I just think that if you're going to go a route of you know, having some potty mouth humor in, yeah, there, then yeah, make it distinguishable so it doesn't just sound like a bunch of swear words put together with laughs.
Is there something that you see? You're going to the Comedy Store a lot now, which I think is, mm-hmm, awesome. How do you First of all, do you still love performing in LA? Is there still like...
I do.
Yeah.
I do. I love performing anywhere. It's not regional anymore.
Yeah.
Listen, the Comedy Cellar in New York City, the Comedy Store, the Laugh Factory, those are like three of the greatest clubs that you can perform at.
Yeah.
You know, everybody that's been there before you, it's a privilege to be able to stand on that stage and to be able to perform. I do the main room primarily at the Comedy Store, excuse me. And there's many nights where I'm walking through there, and I guarantee you probably do the same thing, and you reminisce about who's been here and who you've seen.
Can't help it.
And it's overwhelmingly unbelievable. We're doing this. We're in the, you know, we're backstage where everybody was doing crazy shit back here, and we've heard the stories. So being able to perform now, you know, everywhere, basically, in LA, it's a privilege. It's great to be able to share the stage with all different kinds of comics on different, you know, theme nights.
Do you find yourself being around so many comics now? Do you, I don't know how much you're watching when you're at a show before or after, but do you take note that certain people and have people asked you for advice, like young comics, or like what do you... And what's usually the first thing you...
You
have to gauge what level they're kind of at and what they already...
Of course. And I know how, you know, advice when you're really young, I'm very careful with the advice that I dish out. I'm not going to just like be like, hey, come here, let me talk to you and give you a bunch of advice.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like if you're having a conversation and you're seeking out some understanding of why you're doing what you're doing, if anything, I want to tell you, okay, here's what happened when I did it, and not in a way to make it about me, but in a way to say, I'm not telling you what will or won't work for you. What I'm saying is I had this experience, and this is what I found, you know, came from it. I think with the young comics, you know, being a mentor to younger comedians now, what I always try to impart is, if nothing else, like, take your time and don't try to break so quick, because we're in a society now where if you break quick, and this is happening to a lot of like YouTuber type people, you get millions of followers, you've got a few special pieces that are out there, but that's all you got. And then they take you and they go, oh my God, you're unbelievable. You're not road tested. You haven't been around long enough to even probably have a great lawyer or great team around you.
Right.
And they're going to pull you in and you're in the machine out here. And then when it's all over, you're going to be like, what happened? Well, what happened was you didn't develop enough to have more things to pitch and to tell and to share. So I always tell people, like, just try to like go to New York if you can, hit the road, go to, you know, Tempe Improv, try to like stay low key and don't worry about putting so much up on the internet, because it'll feel like to you like everybody went yes, and then the minute they put you aside because they're clicking something else, that's a hard fall, man. That's that's hard to come back from.
It's also
when you're new, I can't imagine.
Oh, man, yeah.
Where I was,
you
it was
to be
hard.
New once, right?
Dude, I honestly, I always just help you take your time. You know, you know, unless you're starting at 50. You take your time with it and really, really develop your voice.
Did you ever? Oh, so good.
No, just don't you know, don't share it too soon, because then everybody else, then you belong to everybody else, and they're dictating kind of who you are.
Right.
You don't have it. You're not developed enough to stand up for yourself.
Do you feel fortunate that like YouTube and all this wasn't around when you were getting going, so that like you didn't have an opportunity to maybe like put up a set two months in and be like, because I see that all the time now. I've friends from college that are starting or have been doing it, and they'll put up these videos of 3 months in, just because they're like, people need to know that I'm doing this. And
yeah,
I'm like,
no, listen, 3 months in, it's like if I wanted to research something, there was no internet, no Google, nothing. I had to go to the library and do something called microfiche. I mean,
what did you call me?
Microfiche. You're a microfiche, okay? You're worse than, you're just a fiche. You're not even micro yet. So I'm glad that I developed in a time where that wasn't, you know, people didn't know who I was. I really am glad that I was kind of, you know, I felt like I was, you know, way out on the fringe when I first started. Even in Boston, I was just playing these like shit gigs outside of town and, you know, putting it together.
I mean, it is crazy, because I guess your clips, like the Letterman set and the half hour, when things really did start to blossom as far as like sharing and things being out there, then it was like game over, and those things were just getting, you know, circulated all over
the place. Oh, yeah. Yeah. By the time I started uploading my own material to like the Napsters of the world Kazaa and LimeWire, I was, it was solid. You know, it was ready to go. I was ready. I wouldn't have put that stuff out if I didn't go, okay, you know what? This is the best I'm going to be right now. Yeah. I want to try to, you know, see if I can make this, take this to the next level.
Yeah. Well, shit, dude. I could talk to you for hours.
What? This is over already?
We can do more, but we did about an hour and change.
All right.
Yeah.
All right.
And we can keep it going.
No, this feels good. Is there anything that I should be asking you at this point?
You didn't take any of my Jolly Ranchers or Dum Dum suckers. What does the Dane Cook writer look like?
Let's just talk about these scandals for a second, because I'm no detective or junior sleuth, but
well, not with that attitude.
They're brand new. It's almost as if these were lit today for the very first time.
Oh my God!
I'm like Perry fucking Mason in this place.
Oh my God! No junior.
There's
sleuth.
Also one wrapper that I noticed that's in the Jolly Rancher candy bowl, which means that somebody came and had a piece of the Jolly Rancher candy. Do you want to know the truth?
You can look in the direction of Norm, who I just think, I guess the communal bowl of ranchers is also doubles as a garbage can, Norm.
Pleading the fifth over here. Yeah. Just had his big moment. He just
crossroad. Yeah, after I guess once he, yeah, what after the crossroads look up.
If anybody wants to, we added shows. So if anybody wants to get tickets, yeah, we're adding some shows. A couple time. Places are, you know, we're adding a show or we're expanding the dates to other cities. DaneCook.com has the whole tour schedule. So if anybody wants to check.
Awesome. Is there though something specific treat wise that that Dane enjoys? Like if you're a fan and you're bringing something, or if you're just in a certain city, like Wisconsin, obviously you're hitting. Yep. Are you going to go out of your way? Like there's probably going to be flooding,
sure.
A flooding of messages.
My favorite fruit is the tangelo.
What?
Yeah. So if somebody wants to bring me a bushel of tangelo.
Now, I'm no junior sleuth, but I feel like the tangelo is not.
You ever had one?
No. Oh, that's a real fruit?
Oh, a tangelo. You've never had a tangelo?
Don't
Norman, look it up.
Google tangelo again.
No, will you look up tangelo and please tell us?
Yeah.
What's
the origin? Use it in a sentence.
I feel like it's use it in a sentence. The tangelo is not an apple.
That guy says it to the kid during the spelling bee.
I think we got it.
Okay.
It's a hybrid of the tangerine and grapefruit.
Somebody created. It's called the tangelo.
Well, what now? The name does not speak to the pairing of fruits that it.
It sounds like a name that a black family would give their daughter. Yeah,
the Maya Tangelo. Can I still?
You get
her
try
dates?
One. You get her try one. Tangelo is absolutely delicious.
Does it have a? So it's got the tangerine vibe with a little grapefruit center.
Yes, it's kind of its own flavorful experience.
If it were an actor, who would it be? Gary Sinise?
Gary Busey.
There it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. I knew it was. all right, the tangelo. What about, are you going to try to explore in some of these cities, or are you going to be in and out? Like in Wisconsin, they're big on cheese products.
I've been everywhere.
You have.
You know?
You've done the Philly cheesesteak thing.
I've done it.
Chicago pizza.
Yeah. At this point, it's really mostly just focusing on the show, and then we're gonna boogie. It's going to be quick.
I love that.
Yeah.
You're the man. Thanks for making time. Like, you know, again, could just throw compliment city at you all day. But the fact that your comedy is only always growing and getting better, it's like inspiring on many levels. And in a business where you are constantly looking for like those things to motivate you, you know, you got like this is such a self-motivating thing where as many conversations as you can have with friends and family. And like you said, like getting, you know, nice feedback from comedians, all that stuff matters. But like, you got to be the one to be going out there. And, you know, this sounded a lot better in my head.
I thought you were having a stroke.
I am. I guess that's right. I wanted you to be here for my
Well, you're a funny
stroke.
Cat, and thanks, I hope dog. That you would, you know, join me and come out on a couple of these dates here and there.
As many as...
when we get off pod, we'll talk about some dates.
I like how I was about to say, dude, I'll do as many, and you go, dude, just a couple. Like, let's start slow. You definitely very specifically said a couple, so I guess I'll just pinpoint.
You just travel with me at first, but not perform. I just want to feel what it's like having you around. It's like the slowest process to actually perform for me.
Oh my God, yeah. I'll bring all the candles.
No, I like having funny people that know how to come out and whether they're closing a show or opening a show or whatever it is.
The hang is important, right?
Oh man, yeah. It's like this whole journey. We got to, talking about kibitzing and having all these great, you know, look back moments, but still we're excited for what's to come.
Yeah.
I think that's what people, you know, enjoy about coming out to a comedy show in particular, more than music or anything else. You're seeing somebody sharing relevant things that are happening to them and to all of us live. Nothing like that. So I know people are going to have a bang up time if they come out to the show, and hopefully they'll see you on a couple of them.
I love it. Good night, everybody.
Thanks for listening to the About Last Night podcast with Brad Williams and Adam Ray. Boy, they're a lot of fun, huh? Why don't you subscribe on iTunes to this fucking podcast? Give them a 5-star rating so this midget and this Jew can feel good about themselves for a couple minutes. Also, get on your iPhone or Android and get the podcast app. You can also listen to it on Stitcher or aboutlastnightpodcast.com, where you can hear past episodes with great guests like Lisa Kudrow, Paul Feig, Kevin Nealon, Bob Saget, Dion Cole, Chris D'Elia, Adam Devine, Michael McDonald, Jaleel White, Bud Friedman, Steve-O, Harlan Williams, Tom Arnold, Ron Funches, Rick Glassman, Blake Anderson, Anders Holm, Jessamay Peluso, Joey McIntyre, and many, many more. I'm Tony Danza. Thanks for listening to the About Last Night podcast. Good night. That's it, right? You got it? Sweet. Boy, it smells good in that booth, by the way. What kind of candle is that? Hanukkah Willow? Nice.